All right, good morning. Welcome to the third lecture. So yesterday we derived a very, very important result in statistical physics, which is that the equilibrium state of a system, which is subject to some constraints, so we require that there are some expectation values for certain operators, and of course we require that the density matrix is normalized. Then there is a principle of maximal mass, which states, well, the statistical entropy, which is defined over here, has to be maximized, provided these constraints are true. And that leads to this beautiful variational principle, which uses the Lagrange multipliers. And so results in the following Gibbs distribution. So the density matrix is simply given by 1 over z, that is the partition function, and the exponential Lagrange multipliers times the corresponding observables. And z is just trace, basically, of this to guarantee that trace of rho equals to 1. So this is the most general Gibbs distribution you can imagine. And there are many, many statistical ensembles which are just special cases of this Gibbs distribution. Of course, the most useful is the canonical one, where you say the only observable which I allow to fluctuate is the energy. So then I'll have just lambda h, which I call beta. And then ai is just one of them is the Hamiltonian. And then it turns out that if you make the correspondence to thermodynamics, you recover that lambda h is actually 1 over temperature. OK. So now, are there any questions to this? If not, then part C today. So thermodynamic approach. To phase transitions. And of course, the main subject of this course is phase transitions, but we will be looking at them from a microscopic point of view. But it's also good to have in mind that you can say lots of things about these phase transitions just using thermodynamics. But let me start from a slightly different end. So part one, so statistical machinery. Work. So we will sort of pretend that we have the microscopic point of view. And then once we derive what we need to derive, then we switch to thermodynamics back. OK, so basically, every statistical physics problem starts with the fact that you are given a Hamiltonian. So given Hamiltonian H, which characterizes your system, you want to learn as much as you can about the system. And of course, the machinery goes as follows. I have to calculate the corresponding quantities here. So first, calculate the partition function. So I told you that most of the times you can use the canonical ensemble. So then z is simply given by trace of e to the minus beta h, where beta is 1 over t. Okay, so this is what you have to calculate first. And once you know what this partition function is, you calculate the free energy. Energy. So free energy F is just minus T times logarithm of Z. And then you use basically the thermodynamics. You know that this is thermodynamic potential free energy. And so, you know from thermodynamics, I know that the free energy is a function of some variables of temperature, of volume, of number of particles, and that its differential is given by minus S dT minus dV plus mu dN. Okay, and so you can read some interesting quantities about the system. So for example, you know that the entropy is minus dF over dT at constant V and N. You know that pressure is minus dF over dV at constant T and N. And finally, that the chemical potential mu is dF over dN at constant T and V. Okay, so this is how you derive the properties of the system from starting from statistical physics. Okay. So as the general rule, what you have to do. So let me demonstrate that on the simplest possible example, that of the ideal gas. Okay. The example will be ideal gas. And you noticed, if you looked at your homework, that actually you will go beyond approximation of ideal gas in your homework. So I'll do the simplest thing, and then you will do a little bit more difficult things in your homework. To do the real gas, meaning gas which can be dense, is very, very painful. And there are methods which are called cluster integrals, stuff like that. We will not go into that at all. But just, you know, the buzzword is cluster integrals if you want to do real gas. Okay, so now ideal gas, of course, our model of ideal gas is just we have N non-interacting molecules or particles. And so each of them are characterized by the positions and momenta, I 1 to n. Okay, and so then so the first step, so the Hamiltonian is just pi square. Let's say all of them have the same mass m, and that's it. Okay, so they have only kinetic energy. They are non-interacting at all. And so this is the corresponding microscopic Hamiltonian. So then the first step is to calculate the partition function. So the partition function is trace of E minus beta H. Of course, that would be the quantum mechanical prescription, but we know how to translate it for a classical prescription. So you know that the trace just becomes an integral over the phase space. So, and then there is some stupid prefactor 1 over n factorial, 1 over 2 pi h bar. I will set it equal to 1. It doesn't play any role in the end. So this is just an integral dr1 to drn. And then dp1 to dpn, and then e minus beta h, where h is given here. Okay, so that's the partition function. And so now, obviously, you see that you have to do some integrations. So nothing depends on r, so that integration is easy. So each integral over r gives you basically the volume of the gas. So you will have, in the end, volume to some power n, because you have n particles. Each of them can live in the whole volume. So this is equal to v to the n. And then you have integrals of the type of the Gaussian thing. So you have now, an integral dp1, but then you have e minus beta, and then you have p1 square over 2m, and then you have another integral like that, so dpn e minus beta pn square over 2m. So all you need to know is how to do a Gaussian integral, which I never know how to do. So let me just write the formula. Okay, so this one. Well, it's something like 1 over this, whatever stands here. So it's given by 2 pi m over beta, and then square root of that. So that would be for each momentum. So if I have just dp, 1x, then I would have the thing. So now, if you are in d dimensions, let's do it. OK, let's do it in d dimensions. So, and let's do it even more complicated. So d spacetime dimensions. Space-time dimensions. You never see in statistical physics space-time dimensions, right? That's the realm of relativity. So of course, you always talk about spatial dimensions in statistical physics. So spatial dimensions is d minus 1. Okay, so now this is 2 to the power d minus 1. For each of them. And of course, I have n such integrals. So then in the end, you have that your partition function that is just v to the n, and then 2 pi m over beta 2 power n times d minus 1 over 2. Okay, so that's your partition function. So that was the first step. So now you calculate the free energy. The free energy is minus t log z. Okay. So it'll have a term minus t n log v coming from here. And then it will have so minus t minus 1 times t n divided by 2 logarithm of t pi m over beta, but beta is 1 over t, so t pi m t. Okay, so that's the free energy. So now, of course, the most interesting thing is to get an equation of state for our ideal gas. So probably you need to calculate the pressure. So the pressure is just from that formula over here, minus dF over dV at constant T and n. So now if you look at what only depends on V is just the first term. So it's minus, and minus is plus, so it's Tn over V. Okay. So now if you introduce specific volume, which is V over N, then you just recovered the ideal gas law. PV equals to T. So from statistical physics, machinery derived what you are familiar with from your high school, that ideal gas law just has this very simple formula PV equals to T. Okay. So now let me also calculate the entropy and the specific heats. So the entropy just minus df over dt vnm. Okay, so now this is more complicated. I have many terms here. So I have minus n logarithm v plus n logarithm v, and then I'll have two terms out of this one, but plus t minus 1 over 2 n, and then logarithm 2 pi mt. So I differentiated just this t here, and then I differentiate the other one. Of course, that goes like 1 over t, so t disappears. Yes?
Where's the beta go?
Ah, I changed it to 1 over t. I'm using the beta is 1 over t. Okay, and so we recover that this is t minus 1 over 2 times n. Okay, so that's the entropy. So we will use this entropy to calculate the specific heat. But let me first notice an interesting thing. Sorry?
Proportional to n.
Proportional to n, yeah. What is proportional to n? The entropy, OK, so it's proportional to n, yes. OK, so let me calculate the internal energy. And so the internal energy is, of course, the free energy plus T times S. OK, so the free energy is over here. And then if you do T times S, so what do you find? That it's only the last term which actually contributes. It's only this term here. And so this is equal to D minus 1 over 2 N times T. And so the internal energy only depends on temperature. It doesn't depend independent of volume. OK. And so this is actually quite interesting property. And it's a property which sometimes people use as a definition of what an ideal gas means. Okay, so sometimes you will hear, yeah, I'll define an ideal gas to be something, some gas holds energy, internal energy is just a function of temperature. Okay, so now let me also notice another interesting fact, which I don't know what it means, but people are still puzzled by that. Not really. So if you want to look at, you know, where does the pressure come from? Okay, so naively, you would think that it comes from, you know, it comes from the free energy, and the free energy depends on the internal energy and depends on the entropy. So you might be thinking, well, there's some contribution of the internal energy to the pressure. So really, the particles are hitting the walls of our room or whatever, and there might be some contribution from the entropy as well. But it actually turns out that one of the contributions is zero. And it's quite puzzling. So if you look at this, so you know that P is over here. It's minus df over dv. P is minus df over dv. But if you plug what f is, so this is minus d, and then you have u minus ts over dv. But U depends only on temperature. It doesn't depend on volume. So actually, the only contribution from here is actually through the entropy. So this is actually T times dS over dV. OK, so only contribution from entropy . So it's really the pressure comes from the fact that how you redistribute the particles in your room rather than the particles are actually hitting the walls because they have some internal energy. And so this is puzzling. It's only true for ideal gas. But people say that the origin of pressure in ideal gas is entropic. And I think it's an interesting observation. I don't know what it means. But some, you know, people write papers about it. Okay, so why not? Okay, so we have just, you know, a curiosity, I would say. So now you can calculate, you know what S is, and you can calculate the specific heat. So CV is just delta Q over dT. So Q is TdS, so it's TdS over dT, and then you want this at constant volume. So now if you look at your entropy here, you want to differentiate it with respect to T at constant volume. That's interesting. Is it correct? So anyway, the statement is that this should be equal to T minus 1 times N divided by 2. I don't see it, but maybe you do. OK. So now you may also calculate CP. So CP will be the same thing, but now you want to keep fixed P. In order to do that, you have to rewrite your entropy in terms of the pressure rather than the volume. So wherever you see volume, you just have to use the equation of state. And so wherever, so this is V over N. So V is T over P times N. So that's your equation of state. So you take this V, you plug it everywhere in the entropy, and then you differentiate it with respect to P. And if you do it, you should get P plus 1 N over 2. And finally, people are obsessed with the ratio of CV and CP, and it's called Meyer's law. So kappa is CP over CV, and then this is equal to D plus 1 over D minus 1. And so if you are in four dimensions, in our world, it's just 5 over 3. The prediction, if you want. So now this is a prediction for ideal gas, and now you may be studying what is the departure of these things. So specific, well, heats are really, really easy to measure. So that's why actually, you know, this is good for experimentalists. There is some, you know, very, very clear prediction what they should measure and what they should get. And if they get something else, they know, you know, how far we are from departing from ideal gas, for example. Questions? So everybody seen this in your statistical mechanics course? Who hasn't seen this?
Oh, man.
Okay. So that's good. Okay, so that's a repetition. So now, as I said, you will do slightly more complicated thing in your homework, where you actually will add some interactions. And then you will do some expansion in the fact that actually there are interactions, but they are still very, very weak. And you get first approximation to something which is called van der Waals equation. So part B, part 2, van der Waals equation. So if you want an interacting gas, then it's quite complicated. So now your Hamiltonian is just the free Hamiltonian over 2m. And then you add two particle interactions. Where this Wij is a function of Rij, and Rij is just the positions of the particles. Okay. So now you may, for example, use the following model. It's something like A over Rij to the power 12 minus B over Rij to the power 6. And so this is famous Lennard-Jones potential. So this is my distance, this is my Wij, and something like this. And so people model interactions of molecules of gas with this potential. The two-point particle interaction, of course, you can have more than, you know, two-body interactions. You can have three-body and so on. But already this is actually quite complicated to solve, and people don't solve it exactly. And so to get reasonable results, so that is tricky. As I said, there is a method which is called integral cluster expansion. So solved by cluster expansion. Who has seen cluster expansion in the statistical physics course? Okay. So, you know, for the others, just, you know, beware that there is something like, there is some method how to, you know, solve this problem. And if you do it, then you recover the following type of equation of state. So you get P is NT, which is the ideal gas law, but then you get corrections. And so there is basically expansion in N. The coefficients of expansion in general, they depend on T. And so you get an equation of state like that. And in principle, the expansion goes forever. And it's a Taylor expansion in small n. Okay. So now, because the expansion goes forever, it's not very useful. And you never know where to truncate. And actually, I think it's not even guaranteed that even if you expand to more terms, actually you are getting closer to the correct result. So that's why actually people don't really do this. But yeah, there is a procedure how to do it. So now what is actually quite miraculous is that if you take everyday gases, then you don't really need to do this. And rather, you can use something which is called van der Waals equation, which is guest equation. It was not really, well, it was motivated by on some physical grounds. But it's not really an equation which would follow from anything, from any calculation. Rather, you know, it's something like I motivated on physical grounds. It has only two parameters to fit, but it fits once these two parameters are fit, then it basically you can describe any gas. Okay, and so this was an amazing thing. So one, the Waals equation, and it was so amazing that van der Waals was knighted, and he got a Nobel Prize for physics in 1910 for his equation. Okay, van der Waals equation. And so basically, it's like an ideal gas equation, P is equal to T. But then you say, well, P is actually bigger than you would expect by a term like this. So this is my new P. But V is actually smaller than you would expect. And so this is your equation. So now A is a constant, which is bigger than zero, measures attraction between particles . So really what he's saying is that the pressure is effectively bigger than you would expect because there is some attraction in between the particles, and so that's why, well, you have some constant A, and then on dimensional grounds you have this V square here. And then B is sort of related to excluded volume of particles. So because the particles have final size, then it's sort of natural to exclude their volume from the description. And so you are taking B minus B as your effective volume. Okay? So it's described by these two parameters, A and B. And so for each gas, you have to fit these parameters, A and B. Certainly much easier than fit all these expansions in the Taylor series. But then actually you can start making predictions, and the predictions are typically for normal gases which you encounter on the Earth. This is a very, very good equation. Okay. So that's the van der Waals equation. Now what people typically do is that they study isotherms for a given equation of state. So isotherms. In PV diagram. So people plot pressure and volume diagram. And then if you were in ideal gas, and well, PV is equal to T, so it's just boring behavior, something like this. So this is for some temperature. And this would be true for ideal gas everywhere, but this would be true only for T high, for the van der Waals gas. So now if you go for smaller temperatures, actually these things, they start to be deformed because of this presence of A and B. And so you actually find that there is an inflection point, some point here, and then for even lower temperatures, you get something like this thing, oscillation. Okay, so this is an inflection point, sometimes also called critical point. And so below, also this will be T equal to T critical. And this is T smaller than T critical. Okay. So this is what you would get if you plot a PV diagram for this equation. Okay. So now this looks bad. The reason why it looks bad is that if you have the oscillation, then the gas would actually have negative specific heat. Negative specific heat is not allowed in thermodynamics. It's perfectly valid for black hole physics, but in thermodynamics of normal gases, you don't expect it to be. And so there is something wrong with these oscillations, and you cannot really trust the van der Waals equation. And so what really happens there is that you don't see a gas which would be doing this, but rather you see a phase transition. Okay, and so there was a very, very short way from van der Waals equation to description of phase transition. So this is really historically, once the van der Waals equation was here, once this was observed, then people started to understand why phase transitions actually happen. Okay, and so what happens here, and the construction is due to Maxwell, so he's saying, well, actually, I don't see these oscillations, but rather, there is a phase transition happening at some P phase transition. So I'm on a fixed temperature here, and instead of going up, I rather actually start changing the phase, and I'm changing the phase until I continue here. So now, in this, I would have gas here, and I would have liquid here. And so here I'm just changing gas to liquid. Okay. So how do you find this miraculous P of phase transition? And as I said, the construction is due to Maxwell, and it's called Maxwell's equal area law. And so it's an equal area law, so the areas are equal. So this area is equal to that. Okay, so you have to actually cut your curve in such pressure so that the areas are equal there and there. Okay, so in other words, what you require is that this P of phase transition, and now V gas minus V liquid is equal to P dV, V liquid, V gas. So this is what you are saying. That's precisely the statement of equal area law. Or if you want, you can also put it on your side and integrate the circular integral around it and return back, and you get zero. So this is completely equivalent to V dP equals to zero. Okay, so this is construction due to Maxwell, and really people started to understand when the phase transition happens and what is the same Maxwell as Maxwell equations. So he was like really great theoretician. Okay. So not only working on electromagnetism, but also on thermodynamics and other things. Okay. So you will derive this in your tutorial tomorrow. It's actually very, very simple, but yeah. We'll see how this is constructed. Okay, so now questions to this?
Where's the equal area law from?
Where does it come from? You will derive it tomorrow. So here is just, you know, an observation that if I cut it, I replace this oscillating part of an isotherm by this P equal to constant, then I am getting what people observe, that people observe a phase transition at a given pressure. And the construction was, well, I have to cut it where the areas are equal. It's just an observation. Okay. So now what it really comes from, or what people like to think that it comes from, is the discussion of the corresponding free energy. So part three will be really phase transitions. Thermodynamic perspective. So now how nowadays people characterize phase transitions is through the corresponding thermodynamic potential, which will be the Gibbs free energy here. Okay, so characterized by Gibbs free energy. And so G a function of pressure and temperature and other things if you want. And so what people really do is that they plot this Gibbs free energy as function of its variables. The Gibbs free energy always has to be nicely continuous. However, it may intersect itself. So the Gibbs free energy makes some hypersurface in your three-dimensional space, for example, like this. And so it's always continuous, whatever it does. But it may happen that the same Gibbs free energy for the same system actually intersects. And if it intersects, then there is a phase transition in that line. And the line is precisely the coexistence line between the two phases. And so you have one phase here, another phase here. Okay. So (clears control surface. GPT is continuous. But may intersect. May intersect. If it intersects, then we have a phase transition. So phase transition. So now, typically, how the intersection looks like is something like this. So let me just plot it in two-dimensional space. So this function of p and t, so it's like a three-dimensional graph. But let me fix b. Okay, so then you would have something like g here, t here, and this is p equal to constant slice. And so now I have a line of g. But so it's continuous, but it may do something like this. And then it may intersect itself at that point. Okay, and this would be precisely the point where the phase transition happens. Okay, so now how do you know which one is the preferred phase? So it's always the one with the which is the global minimum of the Gibbs free energy. So global minimum of G corresponds to the preferred phase. Probably written the other way around. So preferred phase. So for example, here you would have the minimum here. Well, here you are at the minimum. So now you have more possibilities at this point. You have the point here, you can be here, or you can be here. So now the statement is you are at the global minimum, so you are still continuing here. So now, again, at this point, you have three possibilities. So the global minimum is this one, so this would be the right phase. So there will be phase one here, phase one, and then this guy would be phase two, because that's the global minimum of the Gibbs free energy. Okay. And so although, in principle, this part of the diagram, this part of the phase, is also possible, it's not the thermodynamically preferred one. So for example, if you are changing liquid water, well, that's a stupid example. Let's say I'm melting ice to liquid. So in that case, you would have a phase transition really, you know, melting ice. But it may happen that you still have ice even above 0 degrees, okay? So you know you are warming it up, but it may happen that the phase transition doesn't really happen, and so you are sort of over here. But then this is very idealized system. You know it happens only when things don't go right. But if you shake the system a little bit, then it immediately jumps down. Okay, so this is something like overcooled water and overheated something, overheated ice. So the thermodynamically preferred phase is really the global minimum phase. Okay. So now you can classify phase transitions according to what really happens with the Gibbs free energy. And so this thermodynamic classification is that if you have first order phase transition, so G is continuous always, but the derivative of G is not. Okay, and then you would have higher order or second order and higher. If G is continuous, G prime is continuous, but G double prime not. Okay, that's just a classification. According to Anfest. So now Okay, so of course this is incorrect. When I said, I mean G global minimum. Okay, so if you look at this phase transition here, you see that the global minimum, well, of course it's continuous, but it has a the derivative is not. So this thing would be a first order phase transition. However, if you had something which would be really smooth here, but the first derivative would look like this, then you would have second order phase transition. Okay. Okay. So now what really happens for the van der Waals gas is that if you plot G of van der Waals, then you precisely see what I've been plotting over there. So this is G and T, and you see really something like that. So there will be a first order phase transition here for some pressure. So this is P equal to P1. And then for other pressure, actually, this thing will diminish. So for another pressure, which is slightly higher, actually you see a smaller thing here. And then for another pressure, you just see a point here, and then it becomes smooth. So this, of course, is a critical pressure. And so this is pressure which is smaller than P critical. And this is pressure which is bigger than P critical. So you see that for pressures which are bigger than P critical, everything is smooth and there is no phase transition. If you are exactly at P equal to P critical, then you have the phase transition at this point. But it's actually, well, this is really sort of smooth. So it's a second order phase transition. So this would be a critical point. And then for P smaller than P critical, you would have phase transition here, and it's first order phase transition. Okay. So now, if you plot a 3D picture of this, you see you have this very shape here, and you have to connect this shape here. So it's really 3D picture looks something like this. And now, so we are forming a surface. Well, doesn't really look like that, but people call this type of, so this is described by catastrophic theory, and people call this type of catastrophe, they call it swallow tail, okay? Because it looks like a swallow tail. If you have ever seen swallow and its tail, then this thing, if you have 3D pictures, it's a swallow tail. Okay, so swallow tail. Okay. Okay, observe swallows. And if you have seen Monty Python's, then you know that even King needs to know whether it's African swallow or a mother swallow. Okay, so people really think is that for discussion of phase transitions from the thermodynamic point of view, it's the Gibbs free energy, which is the most important thing. And it tells you everything about the phase transition. It tells you, you know, where the phase transition happens, if it is of the first order or second order. You can also immediately plot the phase diagram. So phase diagram. So now this is my P. It's a PT diagram. And so you basically plot where the phase transition really happens. So you see, so this line corresponds to some P. So this thing corresponds to a fixed P. But then now I know P where it happens, and I can read the T where it happens. Yes.
What would a first order versus second order phase transition look like if we were looking like? Would we be able to observe that if we were looking at a material?
Yes, exactly. It's a very good question. So for example, it's related to these derivatives. These derivatives of Gibbs free energy are related to some physical quantities. And so then you would immediately know that some of the physical quantities would, for example, jump, or they would change continuously and stuff like that. So you could really distinguish whether it's the first order or second order by studying some corresponding quantities. So for example, the first order phase transition requires latent heat. So you know that if you are changing ice to water, you actually have to provide some heat in order to melt the ice. So really, first order phase transition, for example, characterized by latent heat. A second order one doesn't need that. The second order one, in principle, could actually. It's a very good question. We will discuss this much more. But you know, it's the physical quantities are different. They behave differently at the phase transition, and then you can judge, is it first order, second order, whatever.
Wait, okay. So it acts the same? Is what you said? It's different how? Like,
first order, for example, you need to provide latent heat. So if you know that you are changing the phase, and in order to change the phase, you need to pump heat into the system, then you know it's the first order phase transition.
A second order phase
doesn't need that.
It would just change by itself.
Not by itself, but it wouldn't need latent heat. It would be described by something else.
Something else.
Well, okay. So you will see many more examples. Don't worry. Okay. So I can read the corresponding t. Okay, so now I can plot where actually the phase transition happens, and that corresponds to some point here. Now I take a different pressure, and I find a different temperature. And so in the end, you can plot a line where actually the two phases coexist. Of course, it should go through the points I plotted before. And this will be true up to the critical point, because at the critical point, there's the last point of the phase transition whatsoever. So you have the critical point here. And then you have this line where the phase transition happens. So on the left, you have some kind of phase, let's say liquid. On the right, you have another type of phase, gas. And so this line is the coexistence line of the two phases. And of course, if I want to cross from here to there, then I'm changing, it happens exactly at that point of the coexistence line, and I'm changing liquid to gas, or the other way around. Okay, and you can, again, read it from the Gibbs free energy. Okay, so now there are many interesting equations which describe this coexistence line and what really happens, you know, how this line looks like, and it's called Clausius-Clapeyron equation. And you'll derive it tomorrow in your tutorial. So let me just write it. So the shape determined from Clausius-Clapeyron equation and so it basically tells you that dp over dt at the coexistence is given by the difference in specific entropies divided by difference in specific volumes. So it's sg minus sl vg minus vl. And you probably cannot see here. Can you still see there? It really tells you what is the derivative at each point, and you can find what is the relation of p as a function of t on the coexistence by solving this equation. Okay, so that's the Clausius-Clapeyron equation, and it applies to first order phase transitions. First order phase transitions. So this is a first order. If you go from liquid to gas, it's a first order. But it becomes second order at the critical point. So here, actually, it is second order. At that very point, And so to describe what happens at the second order, so second order phase transitions, very, very nice. Basically, in the rest of the course, we will just discuss second order phase transitions because they are much easier to describe. but also because they demonstrate some kind of universality, something that physicists really like because they can explain universality. Okay, so universality means that you study various systems, they undergo various second order phase transitions, but these second order phase transitions, if you look at them in a clever way, look always the same. Okay, and so that's the universality. So now the second order phase transitions, there's a corresponding equation, basically, which is the derivative of this equation, and it's called Ehrenfest equation. So for second order, the analog would be Ehrenfest equations. And again, you will derive these Ehrenfest equations in your tutorial tomorrow. Okay, so I'm just simplifying my life. You will do all the work. but as I said, so second order phase transitions, for example, characterized by Ehrenfest equations, but also they have universality. And so what universality means will be basically the rest of this course. Okay. So we'll be studying mostly second order phase transitions because they are simple and because they are universal. Questions? Who has seen Ehrenfest equations? Nobody's seen Ehrenfest equations. Really? That's good. So we just described liquid gas phase transition. Now, of course, in nature, you have many more types of phase transitions. And I would say that the most familiar is probably solid liquid gas phase transition. So other examples of phase transitions. Most typically, solid liquid gas. So now you are basically extending what we have learned over there, that there is a critical point in the PT diagram, and there is a phase transition between liquid and gas. But we can also have solid. And so the solid, the diagram looks like this. So now you have solid phase here. You have the liquid phase here, and you have the gas phase here. So what we describe by this van der Waals thing is what we cut it here, and we didn't, just describe this part. Okay, and so again, there's first order phase transition going from one to another. So as you are crossing the coexistence line, there'll be a first order phase transition. There's this critical point where it is second order. And the point where all three phases meet is called tricritical point or triple point. Okay. Okay. So now notice a fundamental difference between solid and liquid and gas. And the difference is that this guy goes forever. It doesn't end by a critical point. So there is always a phase transition. If you want to go from liquid to solid or from gas to solid, you have to always undergo a phase transition. Okay? So in other words, you always have to destroy the crystal structure of the solid. To actually, so you have to melt the crystal to have something. So always, what is here is always phase transition. Phase transition. On the other hand, if you want to go from gas to liquid, then you can go a stupid way, so which is this way, and then you have to undergo a phase transition. Or you can go a clever way, and then you don't undergo anything. Okay, so really, liquid and gas are not that fundamentally different, but liquid and gas are very, very different from solid. And so here is really the crystal structure which is different. Okay, so basically you can travel in this phase diagram in the way you want if you are clever enough. And so here really I can go around and so it's obvious that now really liquid and gas are not so different because I can go around, right? Question? Yes.
So I never really understood this diagram. If you're like really far out in the liquid gas diagram, what do you have?
You cannot distinguish the two phases. It's just one phase, and you know it's something which has some properties of liquid, something which has some properties of gas, but you cannot really, you know, tell one from another.
How can you call the bottom gas and the top liquid if you there's like?
Oh,
there's
well, you can sort of call it only in the vicinity of the coexistence line, where you know that this guy has really different properties than that guy.
Okay.
And so in order to go from one to another, you have to undergo a phase transition, in the simplest and you know case. But they are not really, really different. Yeah. So here the properties are different than that guy. But as I go closer and closer to the critical point, the different properties will be less different. And then here, they're just, you cannot distinguish one from another.
So if I have like a pot of water, what does it look like to go through the phase transition as opposed to walking around?
Well, so remember, so here you are traveling in the PT diagram.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying here is that if you have, huge pressures and huge temperatures, I cannot really tell one from another.
Yeah.
But if I have low temperatures and low pressures, they are different. Okay. So really, I would have to start changing the temperatures, and I would observe and pressures, and I would start traveling in this diagram as I change pressure and temperature. And then at one point, you will see, actually, the properties of these things are the same.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the way to look at this. Okay, so now this is solid liquid gas. Now there is something which I want to tell you. I didn't know what it is about 5 years ago, but I think it's really cool. So it's called reentrant phase transitions. Because a phase re-enters. So enters again. So the definition is that a system undergoes a reentrant phase transition if a monotonic variation of one thermodynamic variable results in several phase transitions such that the initial and final state, macroscopically the same as the initial one, is macroscopically similar to initial one. Okay. So that's a definition. So I keep changing one thermodynamic variable, for example, the temperature, and then the system undergoes several phase transitions so that actually in the end, my state looks exactly the same as the state as I started with, macroscopically. Okay. So this was first described, of course, people observe it much before, but first described by Hudson. By an experiment I encourage you to do after you finish this lecture. So he played with a mixture of nicotine and water. So just take a glass of water, start smoking. No, I'm not encourage you to start smoking. And so then you observe an interesting phase diagram. Okay, and so here would be the temperature, and here would be the percentage of nicotine. Okay, and then the phase diagram doesn't look like what we have seen here, but rather it forms a bubble. Okay, so we have a bubble here. And so outside of the bubble, actually, you can sort of, well, you can feed the nicotine into water. So outside of the bubble, you are in completely mixed state. And you cannot tell nicotine from water. So basically, all nicotine gets absorbed in the water, and they form a mixture, which is homogeneous. Mixed state, homogeneous phase. Okay. And so this is true here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here, but not inside the bubble. Inside the bubble, there is a sub-bubble. Okay. And so what happens as you cross from here, from the mixed homogeneous state to here, is that suddenly, actually, the two layers separate. So you will have a layer of nicotine, and you will have a layer of water. So here, it's nicotine above water. Okay, so I start with a mixed state. I cross to this upper part of the bubble. I have nicotine above water. So now, let's say I now start reducing the temperature. So you go here. So you have nicotine and water, and as you cross this cross this thing here, they actually swap. Okay, so now you have water above nicotine. And if you keep reducing the temperature, they again mix together. Okay, so I think this is really, 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 really wonderful. So now, obviously, we observe a reentrant phase transition. So for example, if you start here, we have a mixed phase. Then we do undergo a phase transition. We separate the two phases, then we swap them, and then we have the mixed state again. So this mixed state is the same as that mixed state macroscopically. That's why you observe reentrant phase transition. Okay, so during lunch you can practice this. So.
Why would that happen?
Okay, that's a very, very good question. I will not give you the answer, but basically what happens is that you have to have several phenomena which compete among each other. Okay, so typically this happens for multi-component things, and so it's always the question, you know, which component at this point winning, and so that the properties of the whole thing are after this component, and then it may, you know, be the case that the second component now is winning, but finally the first one wins. Okay, so it happens for multi-component liquids, I write it here, for ferroelectrics, liquid crystals, binary gases, and stuff like that. What is actually quite interesting is that it also happens for higher dimensional black holes. Yes.
remember the order of temperature?
Yes. So you have the actual graph, the print from 1904 in your scripts, and so this happens at 90 degrees. And this is about 60. So you should already start seeing interesting things at 60 degrees. But you also have, this thing is something like 30%. So you have to really put lots of nicotine into your water. Yeah.
You can only have that for higher dimensional black holes?
Yeah, no, so for higher dimensional black holes, what you observe is this thing here. So you don't see the whole bubble, but you see half of the bubble. And then these are black holes in ADS.
Okay.
And so the pressure is something like the cosmological constant. And yeah, you can have. So outside you have large black holes, but if you go here, if you start changing the temperature, suddenly you have first order phase transition to a small black hole, and then if you keep going, actually you return back to large black hole.
And in the sitter you cannot have that?
So in the sitter you can have that, but the caveat here is that if you just want ADS black holes, this happens for d equal to 6. So not in 4 dimensions, not in 5. But in 6 and higher dimensions, this will happen. And the reason why 6 and higher is that, again, as I try to explain here, that you need some competition of you know several behaviors, and which one is winning, it's fine. Okay. So now these things actually, well, what I didn't say is that it's also rotating black holes. So the black holes have to rotate. But if they rotate fast enough in 6 dimensions is that typically the rotating black hole looks like a sphere. Okay, it rotates, but it's a sphere. But now, if you rotate it faster and faster, then the black hole sort of deforms and forms a pancake. Okay, so instead of this, which rotates like that, you actually will see flattening of the horizon. And then in the end, you'll see really, really, really something which is really like that. If you rotate faster and faster. And so actually, this looks like a brain rather than black hole. So this would be like a spherical big thing. This would rather look like a pancake, which has brain-like properties. So now the properties of these things, thermodynamic properties of these things, are completely different to the thermodynamic properties of those things. And so it's a competition which of the properties actually is winning. Whether it's the brain properties of the black hole or actually black hole properties of the black hole. And that's why you can see some things like that. OK. Other questions? Well, why are we asking black hole physics? let me give you another quite, well, there's many, of course. Phase transitions in black holes, space times. But this one is quite interesting because I wrote a paper about it. And that's about an interaction of black holes with cosmic strings. And I think it's quite an interesting phenomenon. And you will see why. So, in your course on relativity, you discuss the Schwarzschild black hole, which is like the simplest black hole. But you know that you can start rotate these black holes, so you can put a spin on the black hole, or you can start charging the black hole, you put a charge on the black hole. Okay. So now if you put the maximal amount of spin, then you get something which is extremely spinning black hole. And if you spin it even faster, then black hole actually doesn't exist. Okay. And similarly, you can put a charge. And if you put as much charge as you can, it's an extremal charge black hole. And you cannot put more charge because you would have naked singularity. Okay. So now, example number 3, equally important as solid liquid gas, is the gravitational Meissner effect. And so what people observed already in the 60s is that if you take the extreme of black holes, for example, charge is equal to the mass of the black hole, then, and you put the black hole in a magnetic field, then this magnetic field actually gets expelled from the black hole. So magnetic field gets expelled from black hole. So now people call it gravitational Meissner effect, because Meissner effect is the effect known from superconductivity, that actually if you have a superconductor, you put it in a uniform magnetic field, the magnetic field get expelled when actually you are in a conducting phase. Okay, so what really happens, what I mean by this, is that typically you would have a black hole, and then you put a magnetic field like this, and so typically the magnetic field, of course, goes inside the horizon and, you know, penetrates the black hole. But if you are exactly at extremality, so this is q smaller than m, but if you are at q equal to m, then actually the field actually goes around. It never crosses the horizon. Okay? And so people call it gravitational Meissner effect. And this is known from 60s. Do you have a question? No. Okay. So this has been known. And so for any extreme black hole, this is true. Not only it has to be the charged one, but it can be the rotating one or any other one. Simply, the magnetic field does not penetrate the black hole. So this is a charged black hole. So you know that the black hole can have mass, but you can also start throwing electrons in it or whatever. So you can charge the black hole. And so now I'm saying that the total charge inside the black hole is exactly equal to the total mass of the black hole.
Is that fact associated with the fact that if we allow the magnetic field to enter, we can charge it more?
It's probably related to that. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So this is known from 60s. So now, what is quite interesting is if you start messing with a cosmic string. Instead, with a magnetic field. So what you can think about cosmic string is basically magnetic field, which is held together with a scale field. Okay, so cosmic string, the model is Abelian-Higgs model. But basically what it is that you have some B field here. So B field here. But you want to localize it so that actually the cosmic string doesn't stretch forever, but it's localized into some finite domain. So this is my cosmic string. It's localized here. So it's held together by a scalar field. So there's a scalar field phi, which sort of holds it together. So it's a magnetic field plus scalar field so that I have finite size cosmic string. Okay, so this is what cosmic string is. You are learning a lot in this course, which is completely irrelevant for statistical physics. Okay. So now what's been observed is that if you take the extreme of black hole and you want to penetrate it with the cosmic string, two things can actually happen. So this is your black hole. If the cosmic string is actually narrow, then the field penetrates. So this is for thin cosmic string. So thin cosmic string penetrates even extremal black hole. Okay. However, if the cosmic string becomes wider, then the radius, well, it's a critical radius, then again, the field of the cosmic string suddenly goes around. So thick cosmic string. And so depending on the radius of, you know, depending on the ratio of how big the black hole is and how big the cosmic string is, you either have penetration or you have expulsion. So there is a phase transition. So there is a critical radius RC when actually, you know, if I am above, I will expel. If I am below, I will penetrate. Okay, so it's a critical radius. Critical radius. And then you can plot a order parameter, which I haven't introduced, but I will talk about it tomorrow. Is that, well, you may look at what is the value of the scalar field of the cosmic string when it penetrates here. So phi at pi equal to 2. Okay. So of course, if it expels, it has to be 0 because this is 0. So phi at pi equal to 2 here is equal to 0. But phi at pi equal to 2 here will be something. Okay. So now you may start changing this radius. And there will be this critical radius here, critical, where actually you start phi equal to pi half equal to 0. Okay, so this is phi of pi half. And then you can plot how it looks for r smaller than r critical, and you will get a diagram like that. Okay, so there will be non-trivial field for r smaller than r critical. It'll be exactly 0 for r bigger than r critical. And so this will be precisely the phase transition here. You will see that this phi equal to pi half, you can think about it as order parameter, which I'll talk about tomorrow. This order parameter in this case changes continuously, but it's not analytic. Here it's identically equal to 0. And here is something non-trivial, so it cannot be analytic everywhere, not analytic here. But it's a typical behavior of second order phase transition. Okay, so this is quite nice that really if you have just the magnetic field, you don't see any phase transition. But if you have magnetic field plus scalar, forming a cosmic string, then you see suddenly a phase transition. Yes?
So this is the radius of the string?
So this thing is really the ratio of the two radii.
Okay.
So let's say I'm setting this guy equal to 1, then yeah, this will be the radius of the string.
Okay. What does it mean for the string to have a radius?
Oh, very good. So this is a field configuration, of course, right? So you have some magnetic field here, and then you have the scale field here. Everything has to be smooth because you are in field theory. So of course, everything extends all the way to infinity. But the magnitude of these things, they decay exponentially. So then you say, well, I am basically 0 at some radius, at some. So then you call that the radius of the string, where basically all the fields sort of diminish to 0.
In the case of black holes, we see this very big difference between having an extremal black hole and having non-extremal black hole in terms of thermodynamics, and that's more like the extremal black holes. We are violating somehow the third law of thermodynamics when we go from non-extremal to extremal, right?
You cannot continuously go from one to another. Yeah.
But do we also have something like that happening in some physical system besides black holes, in the sense that if we take some system and we take its temperature to 0, and then we see different behavior thermodynamically than when they are not at? Or this is just.
Well, you certainly have, so we will talk about it a little bit, is that we will only discuss in this course thermodynamic phase transitions, which happen basically due to thermal fluctuations, if you want. So you have to have non-trivial temperature. Okay, so these are phase transitions which are induced by thermal fluctuations. On the other hand, there are quantum phase transitions which can happen exactly at t equal to 0. There are such phase transitions that can happen. So finally, just to confuse you even more, it says Q equal to M, but if you have M equal to J, so if you have rotating black hole, and you study the same phenomenon, and you plot the same diagram, phi over RC, phi, pi half, and the radius, then you don't see a similar diagram, but you see rather that. So there is actually a finite jump here. And we will learn tomorrow that this is a characteristic of a first order phase transition. So where the order parameter jumps at the critical radius. Okay. So now it's quite interesting because you will learn, well, that if you have symmetries, then these symmetries sort of protect things happening. Okay? So more symmetries you have, nicer phase transitions you have. It means higher order phase transitions you have. This guy is spherically symmetric, so maybe that's why there is no first order phase transition, but there is second order phase transition. This guy is not spherically symmetric. There is no extra symmetry. So maybe that's why you already started a first order phase transition. Maybe. I don't know the answer. But a general rule, so more symmetries you have in the system, nicer phase transitions you have, meaning higher order phase transitions you have. Are there any questions to this? OK, so this is, you know, absolutely out of the scope of the course, but just, you know, for your interest. You should know solid liquid gas phase transition. Maybe you should remember the name reentrant phase transition. Try it during lunch, and this is just, you know, for your fun. Questions?
So, yeah, is this occur in four-dimensional space?
This is in 4D. Yeah, it's in 4D. Okay. Well, thank you, and see you tomorrow.